Okay, so transport coefficients measure the efficiency with which you can transport a conserved quantity over long distances. They're generally calculated using effective kinetic theory, which means you look at small deviations from equilibrium, use weak coupling, and then you're just using equilibrium field theory tools. So what I'm going to show is that you can do the same thing using the 3PI effective theory. So the only actual calculation I've done so far is the conductivity in QED, but hopefully I'll be able to convince you that the method should be generalizable. So basically the motivation here, why should we do the same thing over again using a different method? At least in principle, NPI methods can be used arbitrarily far from equilibrium. And then the second point, and this is purely speculative at this point, but I think that in some sense it's more tractable to go to next to leading order using this type of method. Okay, so the basic idea is there are physically interesting situations where the perturbation theory, standard perturbation theory, is poorly convergent. So you want to try to do something with some non-perturbative techniques that will improve the convergence of the perturbation theory. So the standard example that everybody knows is gauge theories at high temperature, where the hard thermal loop effective theory in many situations gives you better convergence. When you're talking about far from equilibrium dynamics, you can use NPI effective theories, which are defined self-consistently in terms of dressed endpoint functions. So this is the partition function for 2PI QED. So this is similar to what Hertz did in his talk. You couple the fields to the sources, but then in addition, you have these bilinear sources. Then you go take the Legendre transforms and look at the effective action. So then this is defined in terms of the expectation values of the fields and also the resum self-consistent propagators. This is the classical term. These are the terms correspond to the one-loop contributions. And then this functional phi is the sum of all the 2PI diagrams. So this is exactly the same thing that Hertz did for the scalar theories in his talk. So then you get the equations of motion from the stationarity of the action. So you take the derivatives and set them to zero. Then the idea is you get some kind of systematic non-perturbative approximation by expanding phi to some order, so in the loop expansion or the 1 over n expansion or something, and then solving these equations of motion without any further approximation. So then the idea is that if you follow this procedure, the conservation laws that correspond to the global symmetries will be respected to arbitrary order in the approximation. Okay, so this is an example to make it a bit more concrete. This is the 2PI effective action, just copied it down from the other slide. If you look at the equation of motion you get by going d gamma with respect to d, it looks just like a Dyson equation. So the log term gives you d inverse, and then this term gives you the inverse of the bare propagator. And the only thing left that depends on d is the phi functional, which is this term, and you group this thing and call it a self-energy. So for instance, if you calculate phi up to three loop order, when I go d by dd on this diagram, this propagator drops out and you get the bubble. And on this diagram, you get this graph. Okay, so it's well known that there are problems with these kinds of formalisms when you truncate them. You get problems with gauge invariance. And in fact, you expect right away that this is going to happen. You know that the word identities depend on cancellations between different topologies. So, for instance, what I would call the vertex corrections and the self-energy corrections have to cancel against each other. But in the 2PI effective theory, you're talking about using corrected propagators but not corrected vertices, and therefore you expect the word identities won't be satisfied. And of course you can see it right away from the previous example. If I truncated phi at the two-loop level, I just get this contribution to the self-energy. These lines are corrected lines, so I have all the self-energy topologies in here, but I don't have this diagram, so I'm never going to satisfy the word identity. So there's a strategy that's used to handle this, and that is to define a different effective action called the self-consistent effective action, which you define by solving these two equations of motion for the self-consistent solutions, which I'm calling S tilde and D tilde. So they're functions of the field expectation values. You substitute them back in, and that gives you the self-consistent action, which I call gamma tilde.
It's not really a different object. It's just the same object as the image.
Okay. Well, this is a, you know, mathematical definition, so We don't have to argue about the words if we know how we define it. Okay, so the resummed action has some cool properties. You define endpoint functions by taking derivatives with respect to the fields, which are then called external fields. And these endpoint functions give you a complete description of the theory, and they satisfy the normal Ward identities. So this is the basis behind these demonstrations that the action is renormalizable. This was done by Jürgen Burgess and members of his group for scalar theories and for QED. They can show that there's a finite number of local and medium independent counterterms, and in that sense, the theories are normalizable. So I'm not going to talk more about renormalization. I want to talk about the second point, which is that there are relationships between the functional derivatives of the resummed action and the functional derivatives of the 2pi action. So you can see right away that that's going to be the case. It just comes from taking the derivatives and applying the chain rule over and over again. The general idea is that they're integral equations for the endpoint functions in terms of the external fields that we get from the resummed action, and the kernel of those integral equations comes from functional derivatives of this phi functional. So I'm going to show you the ones that we need to calculate the conductivity, but first we have to define a few things. So these are the external propagators, just two functional derivatives of the resummed action with respect to the fields. Then you can also define these vertices. So if I differentiate the bare propagator with respect to the field, that just gives you the classical vertex back. That's just the definition. If you differentiate the resummed propagator with respect to the field, you get a vertex like this, two fermions, and one external photon field, which I indicate with an arrow on the end. And when I differentiate this propagator with respect to A, then I get a three-photon field where one of the lines is the external field. Okay, then I also define some four-point functions. If I differentiate the phi functional with respect to two fermion propagators, I get this thing I call MSS, and this is a picture of it. The four-point function is the blob, and there are four fermion legs attached to it. Then the legs on both sides of the semicolon are lines that are going to be attached by a pinching pair, and I'll explain that in a second when I get to it. Then you can also differentiate with respect to S and D, and you get something where... Oh, well, this is wrong. Sorry. Two of these lines are supposed to be dotted because two of them are supposed to be photons. Or you could do it the other way around, or you could have a four-photon vertex. Okay, so using that notation, you can write down a type of Bethe-Salpeter equation for the vertices, which you just get by taking a functional derivative of the Dyson equation. So these are the two Dyson equations. This is the one that I showed you before. You get something exactly the same for the fermion propagator. S inverse is equal to SO inverse, and then this thing, which you identify as the self-energy. And if you take derivatives of these equations with respect to A, so if I do d by dA on S inverse, this gives me lambda. That's the definition. If I go d by dA on S0 inverse, you get the bare vertex. And when you go d by dA on this, you apply the chain rule because both these things depend on A. You get two terms when each of them has a different M vertex. This has four fermion legs, and this has two fermion legs and two photon legs. And you can do exactly the same thing on this equation, and you get an integral equation for omega. That's what we call the thing with two photon legs and one external photon. Okay, so if I use those equations, then I can write the external propagator in a compact way. So this is the equation for the propagator. I just copied it down from before. If you go d by dA twice on the effective action, you get a whole slew of terms. But you can rearrange the whole thing into a neat form by sucking up a bunch of the messy stuff and sticking it into this vertex, which you got from the Bethe-Salpeter equation from the previous slide. So when you write it in this way, you can see that the external propagator will satisfy the usual Ward identity. And in fact, you don't even have to calculate anything to see that or to see how it basically works. The idea is that the Dyson equations are resumming all the S channels, so they're summing up all the self-energies. And the Bethe-Salpeter equations are sticking back in the T and the U channels. So you can see that they're putting in these vertical ladders, and those are the topologies that were missing before. So that when you put those in, the crossing symmetry is restored and you get back the Ward identity.
Again, sort of slightly puzzled. So you started with the 2pi effective action.
Mm-hmm.
you simply said, solve for the stationary values of the propagators and now view it as a function of the external field.
Right.
And you say this is now a wonderful gauge invariant effective action which will satisfy Ward identities. But now I want to make truncations, right? I can't evaluate it exactly.
So when you calculated those...
you're saying interact with the fact that...
when you calculated those self-consistent propagators, you made a truncation. Because that's how you calculated them. You calculated by to some order, and then you found the minimum, and that gave you those solutions. I mean, there is a problem with gauge invariance. It's going to come back on you.
Everything she said is true for any loop expansion, monograph expansion. So it was not just for the exit theory.
Absolutely. But initially there was an argument that says we shouldn't be surprised if we have problems with Ward identities using 2PI resummations. And now you're saying, simply by massaging it the way you did, it sounded like you're saying, like, Ward identities are in good shape.
When you reorganize it this way, then these external endpoint functions satisfy the Ward identity.
External.
Yeah.
But this is still fundamentally 2PI.
This is 2PI, yeah.
In a different way.
Yeah. Okay, so if you look at this equation, you can extract what you would normally call pi. That's this thing. And when you draw a picture of it, it just looks like this. So this is the form that you would expect to get from the Swinger-Dyson equation. Okay, so now you try to use this formalism to calculate the conductivity. So this is the Kubo formula for the conductivity. You want to calculate the self-energy. But when you actually go to do this, you find that there's an infinite number of terms that contribute at the same order. And this basically comes around because of the low frequency limit in the Kubo formula. So what happens is you get these pairs of retarded and advanced propagators that carry the same momentum, which means you have to do integrals that look like this. This thing is called a pinch singularity. You say that the contour is pinched between the poles of the two types of propagators. So you regulate that singularity by using resum propagators, which physically means you're putting on the thermal width to the propagators to regulate it. But when you do that, you get extra factors of coupling in the denominators, so that throws off all your power counting. And the result is that there's actually an infinite set of graphs that contain the product of these pinching pairs that all have to be resummed. So the way to do that is to use an integral equation for the vertex. So this is the equation that we had for pi from whatever two slides ago. And you need an integral equation for this vertex that resums all these pinched terms. Then you sort of connect this to physics by showing that the kernel of this integral equation is the square of the matrix elements that corresponds to 2-to-2 scattering and production processes. And this is the famous result from Arnold Moore and Yaffe using kinetic theory back in the day. Okay. So, so what I'm going to show is that this integral equation can be produced by the 2PI formalism. Okay, so these are the two beta Salpeter equations we had. This is the equation for lambda, and this is the one for omega. Now they're coupled. This is omega in the lambda equation, and there's a lambda in the omega equation. So I substitute one into the other, and I keep everything up to two loop order because that's the order I'm going to need. And then I get this equation for lambda. So then I have to tell you what the gray blobs are. So those are the four-point functions. And I get them by taking derivatives of the phi functional. So if I expand this to three-loop order, I have these two graphs. If I go d by ds twice on this graph, you lose these two propagators, and you just have the photon rung in there. And then on this graph, if you take out these two propagators, you get this graph. And then this graph comes from taking out two of them that are not cross-connected. When you go dsdd, this one-loop graph gives you these two rungs, and then there isn't anything connected that you get from the three-loop graph. So then the idea is you take these expressions for the four-point functions, and you stuff them into this integral equation for lambda, and you do keep everything up to two-loop order. And that gives you this integral equation for lambda. So this is lambda here is equal to lambda naught plus all these four-point functions gives you the kernel, and it's all multiplied by lambda on the right-hand side. So if you write it down mathematically, it's the real part of lambda is equal to the real part of lambda naught times this kernel times the real part of lambda. So then it's a bit tricky. All these hats come from tracing over the Dirac structure, and you have to watch all the Caldes indices and get everything to work out right. But the point is that the kernel of this integral equation comes from the real part of all these four-point matrix elements that I showed you in this picture. And then what you want to do is to show you that that gives you the correct amplitudes for the scattering. Okay, so at the tune-up level, it was done by Hurt and Jose Martinez-Resco. They showed that the square of all the contributions from the tune-up level gives you the S channel, which is a complete result to leading log order. Then what I did with my student Edward Kovlichuk is to show that at three-loop order, you get also the T and the U channels and all the cross terms. And so that gives you the full matrix element. So just a couple of examples. This is the diagram that I labeled F. When you cut that, you get the square of the T channel for electron-positron scattering. This diagram gives you a cross term between the T channel and the S channel. And you just have to work the whole thing out. Okay, so the next problem is that when you resum all these pinch contributions, you don't get the full leading order contribution. And it's easy to see how that comes about. If you look at this 2-2 graph and this 2-3 graph, this one is formally higher order because you've got an extra vertex in it. But if this intermediate line here is collinear, so if the virtuality is small, then this graph can be enhanced. And when you look at it carefully, you see that there's actually an infinite series of collinear graphs that have to be resummed, and that's the LPM effect. So what that means for our purposes is that you need to solve two coupled integral equations that resum the pinching and the collinear singularities. So I'm going to do this using the 3PI effect of action. So you might ask, why would I want to do this using 3PI? Why does that seem like a natural thing to do? Well, we already saw that you need the three-loop diagrams to get the T and the U channels in order to get the full matrix element. And then it was shown by Jürgen that the infinite PI effective action is equal to the 3PI effective action at the three-loop level. So that tells us that if you're going to do something at the three-loop level, there's physics from the three-loop level that needs to be included, that you could expect to get all of it if you use the 3PI effective action. And the result is that it works. There are two integral equations that sum these singularities. So I'm just going to sort of very briefly sketch how it works. This is the 3PI effective action. So this is the classical piece. These are the one-loop terms. And then it's usually divided into these two pieces where this one contains classical vertices and this one doesn't. So then you need to extract the resummed effective action. So in this case, you have seven equations of motion which come from differentiating with respect to all the fields. You solve the last four of them simultaneously for the self-consistent solutions, substitute them back in, and get this resummed action. So now these vertices V and U are self-consistent vertices from within the 3PI formalism. So this is a picture of all the vertices that we have. V is the two fermion photon vertex, the self-consistent one, and U is the three photon self-consistent vertex. Lambda is, as before, the one with the external photon field, and omega has one external photon field. Okay, so when you do this, you have the same type of Beta-Salpeter integral equation that you had before. You've got two equations of motions from taking functional derivatives with respect to S and D, and then you differentiate with respect to A, and you get the Beta-Salpeter equations again. Now, there's tons and tons of terms here because these vertices also depend on A, so you have to differentiate the vertices. You get a whole great big mess, but at the end of the day, there's lots of cancellations, and it can all be gathered up. When you substitute the omega equation into the lambda equation, this is what you get for the integral equation for lambda. Then this is coupled to the integral equation for U, because these things have their own integral equation. That's this one. This just comes from going d lambda or d omega du is equal to zero. And then that equation is coupled to the equation for V, for the self-consistent vertex for three photons, which came from d lambda dv is equal to zero, and that's this equation. So the three of these are coupled to each other. If you substitute them into each other and keep everything up to three-loop order, you get this equation for lambda, and that's coupled to this equation for V. So the first integral equation is exactly the same as the one we had before for 2pi, except now these vertices are self-consistently determined through this equation. And these two equations are exactly the same as the one found using kinetic theory. And they've also been found by Gagnon and John using a different method. Okay, so I think that the method should be generalizable to the study of other transport coefficients or other theories. It'll be slightly more complicated, but the method should work. I think it should be possible to do it at next to leading order. The key idea here is that all of these leading order terms appear naturally. You don't have to do any power counting. So once you understand the structure of it, you don't have to think at all anymore. You just sort of do the NPI crank, and the whole thing comes out. Okay, so then just at the end, I want to say a couple things about problems with this. We know that the external endpoint functions satisfy the word identities using the mechanism that I described, but you could get gauge dependence from the internal or the self-consistent propagators. So I'm going to basically say what we know about this and how I think it works, and then maybe we can discuss from there. Okay, so what we know is that if you calculate the 2pi effective action to L loop order, so that's the order g to the 2l minus 2, then you get gauge-dependent terms that appear at higher order, at order g to the 2l. So this was proved from looking at the behavior of the effective action under BRS transformations by Jan Schmidt and, I don't know how to say his name, but... What was that? Okay, I will point to you when I need to say that. Then it was proven a different way by me with Gabor Kunstadter and Haytham Zarakat using the 2pi Nielsen identities. So this was basically like a bootstrap from the paper by Kobus, Kunstadter, and Rabban when they discussed this issue back in the 90s with the hard thermal loop effective action. They showed that whatever physical quantities you calculate from the hard thermal loop effective action have to be gauge invariant. We use the same method here, basically. The idea is that the explicit gauge dependence of the action is compensated for by the gauge dependence of the VEP. Okay, so if the action is gauge invariant to some order in the truncation, the self-consistent propagators are calculated numerically by minimizing the action. I would expect they would also be gauge invariant to that order in the truncation. And certainly I should think it would be true for thermodynamic variables. The only case where I know where this was checked is the calculation of the two-loop QED pressure in 2pi. And they found that the gauge dependence was of order e to the 4, so that it satisfies the idea that I'm describing. And that's all I have.
On your preceding slide, you had a point NNLO.
NN what?
Next to next to leading order.
Okay, whatever.
Is that what did you mean by that?
I don't, maybe there's too many N's in that. I mean, the next leading order beyond the one we already know.
So I guess NLO would then be also a nice question.
That's a good question.
So according to that, go to for loop for PI.
Yeah, that would be the idea.
Tedious.
Yeah, but I mean, it is kind of, when I did this, I did it for phi cube theory because I didn't know what I was doing and it took me months. And then once I understood how to do it, then I did this QED problem in about a week. I mean, it's not going to be, you know, that easy to do shear viscosity and QED. But it is, you know, there's a, you do it with Mathematica. There's a, you know, there's a system. You just write down these equations, you solve them, you plug the stuff back in. And stuff's canceling all over the place. I don't know. I mean, I haven't done it, so I can't say it's doable, but I think it's a reasonable way to try it.
And what were the possibilities for going away from equilibrium? And what would be the first sort of project to try to do away from equilibrium?
Yeah, I don't know.
In principle, you could do the same as with 2pi, except that you have more equations.
the equations are formulatable.
Obvious, you know, that there's a niche where this would be the best method?
Well, if you want to follow the mean fields and also watch them relax in the way that they're supposed to according to linear response, then that's what you could do this way, I guess. I still have some issues with the gauge dependence, but we can talk about it.
But just to understand it, so this would be getting serious about evaluating every one of the equations you showed us sort of out of equilibrium. So that means doing all three-loop vacuum graphs with completely numerically determined propagators.
Yeah, it would all be
integral differential equations.
It would be fun.
Yeah.
But.
No, it's certainly complex, no question. But it's a complex question.
Well, for example, if you could do this for QCD, you would be able to answer long-standing questions. You could go, for example, from an initial state which has correlations like colored glass, where there are strong mean fields, to the final state where there are particles, and not the hybridization, but still within the QCD phase where you have particles. And you could watch that evolution, and it would be interesting to do some estimates, I would think, if you have strong fields. Before you go and do a full-fledged numerical program, is it going to help you to understand thermalization, for example?
Mm-hmm. So there is, I mean, a student of mine is doing that for two-loop pure glue, and it's not, I mean, it's certainly a big task, but it's doable for a student also.
Only for a student.
He gave the impression it's something very big. You shouldn't forget, it's not that you have to solve a self-consistent Shringer-Dyson equation by finding some nasty zeros in a high-dimensional equation. It's a time evolution equation.
Yeah.
So it's causal.
Yeah.
On the right-hand side, always terms at earlier times appear. So on a computer, you never have to use a Newton method or, you know, any complicated method. You just have to sum up terms that appear, that are explicitly known. It's very simple. If you like them, this non-equilibrium evolution is much more simple than the corresponding equilibrium calculation in that respect.
Well, yeah, but there's a huge jump between going from what you just described to something where you have numerically determined effective vertices that are coming out of a beta Saul-Peter type equation with some non-trivial four-leg kernel. I mean, so yeah, it's just an integral.
It's just an integral equation.
But yeah, I mean, you've got what, 12 variables or something that you're.
But I think that's not the problem. It's again causal. It's again just memory. But what is a problem is that these are loop expansions. Do you want to really apply these loop expansions to QCD, where you have propagators that certainly in the low momentum regime will not be describable by a loop expansion? So I think it's more the question in what sense can these approximations treat non-perturbative physics? Non-perturbative not meaning you need to sum up the whole pinch singularities to get the leading order and the coupling. Non-perturbative meaning that you have things like confinement, which you have in QCD, and, well, that's certainly something one has to approach slowly. For instance, we are implementing these techniques in classical statistical pure gauge theory to compare two PI truncation schemes with simulation results, mm-hmm. where you know you have the exact mm-hmm. result. So just to jump ahead and say I can describe from loop expansions, confinement physics is certainly something you have to.
I don't think she's saying that.
No, but I think that's the problem.
No, but what Emil said, actually, I thought, highlighted the fact that there's a lot of interesting physics one could hope to understand much better before confronting confinement physics.
I mean, we have at this moment no consistent way to go from correlated initial conditions, like some people think are there in the initial state in heavy ion collision, down to the phase in which there are lots of uncorrelated particles. And that's the point. The kinetic theory describes the particle interactions. The mean field theory describes the coherent condensate. But you need to get from one to the other. You need a system of equations that has them both in some consistent way, even if it's somehow limited to weak coupling in the deep QGP phase. It would be nice to have some formalism that could actually do this. But I agree that before plunging into numerics, it would be nice to understand what, you know, are there some new timescales that could emerge that would make it worthwhile to do this in detail.
So, you know, you made strong statements last time about gauge fixing dependence appearing not.
Well, the issue is this. So, we went back, I remember this paper of Smith and Ariza Balaga, did I say it right? And so I went back and looked at that again after we had our discussion. And what they prove is basically that if you essentially re-expand everything in coupling so that you actually have then a reasonable way to estimate the order of terms in the coupling constant, then those gauge-dependent issues are pushed to higher order coupling. However, that's not, I think, what you're doing when you do 2PI because you're resumming. So if you were to re-expand the 2PI back in terms of coupling constant or loop expansion, then what they say applies. But if you don't,
this question is then.
But if you don't do that by keeping the 2PI full action and with resum propagated, then I don't see how you estimate the order. And if you look in detail, so I haven't looked at the 3PI expressions that you have, but if it's certainly at 2PI level, there are gauge parameter dependencies remaining. So if you look at the evolution of the mean field, so you have an A field, right, say in QED, you have all these consistent vertices, and now you have an effective action for just the one-point function, the A field. You write down its equation of motion. That equation of motion will still have gauge parameter dependence. So the electric field or the magnetic field you get out in the Abelian theory will have gauge parameter dependence.
And then what order is it? You can tell by looking at it that it's going to be the same order as...
Well, it doesn't really make sense to talk about order because you've resummed orders. Now, if you re-expand them again, so take some g, you're not going to take it zero, so you're going to take it small but finite, and now you write your equations and solve them.
So if I assume g is small, I can resum all I want. I still have g small, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
but you re-expand your solution again.
So, but if you re-expand your solution, then you're going to recover all the problems of secular terms and that you were trying to solve by doing the 2PI. So that is practically not a useful bound.
Well, I think all...
But I can, if you want, I can prepare something.
In these papers about Alexander Lager and also next papers, all they tried to say was, if you have a small coupling, then you know a priori that by resumming, the error you will gain from gauge fixing dependence will be parametrically, if you could expand, will be parametrically higher order in the coupling. So if you have a small coupling, it's in that sense, and not more, just in that sense. Same.
Yeah, I don't think it's the same thing as saying you have to expand everything back.
No.
Well, that's the only way to control the order of the coupling.
But it's an a priori statement. So whatever you get now, if you assume the coupling is weak, it's fine in that sense.
Okay, if you like, I can give a discussion of this at some point. Because we've, I think, made some progress in understanding how to do that, which is very close to what you guys are doing, but not exactly. And I think it can solve this gauge parameter dependence. So, if you want, I can do that. I'm not ready. I mean, I can We can try now, but I'll probably goof up, so it'll be better to prepare. But do you do understand what maybe we should leave it. Do it.
It is the question of whether higher order is one power of g or square root of g or something.
The point is that orders get mixed up in these recent mentions. So you write down an action, and if you take it as it is for any coupling g, it may be small. You can take it as small as you like, but finally you're going to take some finite value. And then you're going to get some finite gauge parameter dependence. And you're trying to evaluate things which involve a resummation, so you can't just re-expand them in G. That doesn't make any sense. Then you've lost the whole point. Back to doing the ordinary loop expansion. Then we know what the...
There's an order of limits. Now you're just saying you can't use a well-defined procedure for taking the answer and expanding in G if the extension expansion exists. And there's and that's first summing, if you want, first summing, solving, and then expanding, or first expanding, solving. And the two might not be the same.
That's right. That's right.
But so the question is, well, as I understood, the claim was about the second, which is the relevant, interesting.
So say again, the second was?
Maybe that's not true. Because it's based on the resummation procedure. So you resum, solve,
yeah,
and then expand. And I would suspect that if there's some order of ambiguity problem, then it probably isn't just a power seeking expansion.
Right.
I mean,
the whole point, one of the points for doing the resummation is because you have secular terms in the ordinary loop expansion. So if you solve the equations and find a good late time limit, that late time limit does not commute with the loop expansion.
But that's the same you do with kinetic, mm-hmm, with any resummation technique. That's what everybody does. It's not specific to NPI.
Mm-hmm.
You always have to resum the secular terms or pinch singularities in equilibrium. Get the leading order.
But the kinetic theory, you can't ask this question about gauge dependence, right? I mean, you're just looking at scattering on shell, essentially. So there isn't any field theoretic formulation of gauge parameter dependence that I know.
What I would like to understand is, I mean, you can start from what Mac was writing down and do the same approximations that you do in kinetic theory. You can do derivative expansion. You can do the very same steps, and you end up also with kinetic theory. I mean, this theory includes kinetic theory.
Yeah, but if you go to the kinetic limit by doing, you know, that's yet another level of approximation. So if you go on top to the field theory and say, I'm now going to do gradient expansions, and
something goes wrong if you don't do these other approximations that you do to go to kinetic theory?
I didn't say that. I'm saying that if you go to the kinetic limit, some of these gauge parameter issues might disappear, but that's only a piece of what this thing contains, right? It contains more than just the kinetic theory limit. Because you don't have to make a gradient expansion. You don't have to go to the kinetic theory limit. She has a field theoretic, you have a field theoretic formulation. So it's in that field theoretic formulation that the gauge parameter issue is still there, not in the kinetic limit, I think.
But what I don't understand is why, so you have to re-expand it. I mean, when you sum up the LPL diagrams and you calculate photon production, the results of order GQ or whatever it is, you don't say that you don't know what order it is. You wouldn't dream of re-expanding it.
This Arizala-Palaga-Smith argument, which is a formal argument about DRS and orders of perturbation theory, I think in order to make sense of that, you have to re-expand it.
Okay, I haven't looked at that paper in a while.
Sorry, just look at that. Let's discuss that.
But I don't think it's the case with the paper that I wrote, that you're talking about re-expanding. I mean, you're right. If you have to re-expand it, then it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, well, in order to apply the Arizabalaga-Schmidt argument to your work, I think you have to re-expand it. If you have a different argument, I'd like to hear.
Okay, well, it was in the paper that was with the board.
Okay, so let me read it.
Okay, I'll read the...
let's have a...
Continuation.
Continuation based on some facts rather than statements.
So in terms of actually doing NPI calculations with some form of physically interesting non-equilibrium initial data, the state of the art is two-loop, 2PI pure scalar, or, well, scalar plus in Kawatek theories.
No, I mean, Herr discussed this. There is a, so two types of approximation have been tried so far. One is loop expanding, one is 1/n expanding.
Absolutely, absolutely. In terms of the structure of the equations you're solving, though, that's not really a significant difference.
Well, with Anders-Tanberg, we've written the next to next to linear and 1/n, so that would be, that would give you cell energies which have internal, two internal vertices. And so, well, we've written down the causal equations, which is just some work, and then we coded it in zero dimensions, so quantum mechanics.
I think if there would have been any reason so far to go beyond that, but these approximations, whenever you test it against, and there are not too many strict tests that can be done, for instance, calculating critical exponents, going to the classical statistical field theory middle, so one's implementing the truncation scheme and one's comparing to exact results. Practically all the time lies on top of the exact results. So there was not too much pressure so far in these scalar and fermionic theories to go beyond. It was all captured. And as I said, for instance, even in 1 plus 1, where perturbatively you would expect that these approximations would fail miserably, because in 1 plus 1 dimension you just have scattering processes beyond those that have been included so far, you find that it practically lies on top of the exact result. So you may also ask the question, in what sense, or why these loop or 1/n expansions of the Dreesum theory are so successful at low orders? You can turn it around. I think the big thing that is still, for practical purposes, missing are applications to gauge theories. It's not so much asking whether one can beyond, go beyond in the scalar or fermionic case. I think that's rather well tested and understood. That's not the case for gauge theories. That has also to do with this psychological saying. Everybody says, oh, there is a problem, there is a problem. But when you go down to real calculations like Meg did...
This I have to object to. I mean, I can show you why it is a problem. I mean, okay, look. At 2PI level...
You provoked it.
Yeah, you provoked it. Yeah,
it's my touch.
This was point.
Emil, hit the lights, please.
Yes. Hit the on, off button on the remote control, then the screen goes off.
Which is the screen?
On the lights,
I'm just going to make a very simple. So if you look at, say, at 2PI level, the simplest gauge theory we can look at, then you guys are going to tell us to look at a graph like this, where these are Dreesum propagators, right? But the vertex is bare. So it's a very simple exercise to now ask, how do I define this propagator? Obviously, in this 2PI formalism, I get a proper vertex, which is the inverse. But as usual in the gauge theory, in order to go to D, I have to invert that, and it's not invertible, it's a projector. So I have to add a gauge fixing to it. Right? Something like this. You now ask, in this class of covariant gauges, does this gauge parameter dependence drop out of this thing at the level of the action? So no issue about propagators or gauge dependence there.
K to the fourth.
K to the fourth. And it's easy to see that when you take why does gauge invariance usually work? Well, it usually works because the propagator, if you put its signature back on the field, the inverse of its propagator, there is respect to A, is the vertex, right? This is in the exact series. So there has to be a relationship between the propagator and the vertex in order for these terms to vanish. Here there is not, because you're doing a resum propagator with this S inverse, is the S0 inverse, plus a proper self-energy obtained from this 2PI diagram, but you do not have that self-energy or the variation of it in the vertex, which is paired. So it's simply gauge parameter dependent. Period. Now, how that's actually going to, you know, manifest itself in evolution has not been studied, but I think it's more than a psychological problem. It's a fact. So in order to fix that, you have to have, since we take it as granted that you have to resum the propagator in order to get the right secular behaviors, then you're going to have to do something with the vertex. Now, Mega's taken a step in that direction by going to 3PI. But I think 2PI
but also
does not contain enough information.
Also, in 2PI, you have equation for the endpoint vertices, because you have a generating functional, so you can just keep on differentiating with respect to the sources.
To the external field.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you get, for instance, just purely 2PI, with no mean field back, no background mean field, you get this four-point basis of theta type of equation.
Yes.
It's within the formalism.
Yes.
And it obeys, it has certain properties, so that when you use, for instance, to compute transport coefficient, it all works out nicely, gauge dependence drops out and so on. So I think it's to say, well, this diagram has only bare vertices with full propagators. That's not the full story, because there is a vertex equation in the 2PI or NPI form.
Yes, so one of the things I think Meg mentioned in passing is in all of these truncation schemes, it's important to separate what I call, or I think you also call, external from internal. So when you have the action and you have it as a functional of external fields, the background field method, you can vary with respect to those fields, and that gives you some external vertices which satisfy integral equations. However, inside the loops are internal vertices. So normally, if you were doing a consistent expansion, these are one and the same up to a given order. Here they are not. So the actual vertex that enters in the evolution equations is not the vertex that you solve for by your external variation. So I think if you did this in an external field, if you tried to do QED with a background field, the kind of warm-up to doing the QCD problem that we're talking about, then you would get, you know, a Maxwell equation coupling to some current, and that current would have, from this diagram, things like this, this current insertion. It would have one loop terms and it would have two loop terms. This two loop term, because of this bare vertex, will have this residual C dependence. And if I solve this Maxwell equation, looking at the time evolution, and just, you know, put a small parameter G, a small parameter E, but finite, and solve this equation, I will get some time evolution on some initial conditions. I bet you, as much as you want, that it will depend on C. So if I do it for different C, I'll get a different evolution.
But that the internal lines have this psi dependence, that is well understood. That's, I mean, like...
Yes, so you agree it's not psychological.
No, but...
Well, in this paper that I showed you, he calculates the psi dependence.
Which paper?
The last one, by this other guy's name, I can't say...
No, or is it Balog and Smith?
No, not that one. The other
with
one.
Reynosa and Zero?
Reynosa and the guy with the B.
Bojani.
He's going to be here, so we'll talk.
They calculate the pressure, and they plot some C dependence from the internal lines, but it's more than e to the fourth, and they calculate the pressure over e squared. So it's not enough just to say it depends on C, you have to say it depends on
which quantities and how they depend is an issue.
Which quantities is key here? right? I mean,
exactly.
No, it may well be, and I think we may be able to show this more generally, that certain quantities are insensitive to the C dependence to a given order. So what you mentioned is, I think, it's kind of experimental evidence, right? Did they actually prove it, or did they just evaluate it numerically for several cases?
They evaluated it, the QED pressure in two loops, using two PI.
So I think what may well be the case, and I'm speculating, is that certain soft quantities in the late time limit may be insensitive to this, to a given order. But certainly, time-dependent transients in here are going to be generally dependent on them. I don't think there's no reason why it should be so. And I don't know what it means to talk about orders here.
So now, why should this bother you?
Well, if I don't know how to answer that.
No, this is a serious question, but it starts with Gergen saying it's a psychological barrier, right? But on the one hand, you're making some sort of approximation, right? There's going to be some error.
Yes.
Exactly how you make that approximation, there's going to be different error. What you described is really just one way of putting in a parameter which actually gives you a way of studying the size of that sensitivity. And surely it will depend on what problem you're applying it to, and it's very different looking at pressure in equilibrium from looking at some sort of real-time evolution, and that's going to depend on what initial conditions you want to start from.
I think the reason you might be concerned is this is a parameter that couples to physics.
Yeah, right. So this is not a physical interpretation.
You're not making an approximation by screwing up some of the physical degrees of freedom. You're adding new to unphysical.
So certainly you want to have some sort of expansion parameter. For instance, this issue that it's still high order in coupling.
I mean, the problem is it's not controlled. I mean, you can always take the point of view that you're doing phenomenology, so you'll throw in some parameter, and you'll let it vary and see what you get. But, I don't know, call it psychological. I think what we're supposed to be doing is trying to control the approximation in some extent. And if one can show in certain quantities that the parameter drops out to a given order, fine and good. But then, because what you're really going to do most likely is go to some gauge and then solve the evolution, how will I be able to take that seriously unless you do an extremely thorough investigation of the primary dependence? So it would be better, I would say, to have a formulation which doesn't have this problem, and that's what I'd like to talk about at some point.
So you think there is a formulation which is not a loop expansion, which isn't gauge invariant theory?
There is a formulation which
there's
is not
a gauge invariant expansion that is not a loop expansion that is gauge invariant.
You have to take, parts of diagrams and not the full. You kind of just the
diagram.
Yeah.
But you think that in principle, even in the Gaussian theory, there is an expansion, well-defined expansion in the Gaussian variant, and it's not the loop expansion.
It's a reordering of the loop expansion.
That's
exactly the
point. Where you fit the specific parts of diagrams.
Right.
But this is a horrible example.
Is some
packaging of kinetic theory. So the moment you say hard thermal loops, if you're in this domain of validity, you're in the same domain where we just could have discussed it from kinetic theory.
Oh, but it's an example.
That's beautiful, but that's a very special area of applicability. So don't think that by studying hard thermal loops, you're addressing more general problems.
Well, no, but it's an example of the formulation which is not just a loop expansion.
That's right.
Which is gauge invariant.
That's right. So So
and you pick still piece of diagrams.
That's right. And you can justify okay, that formally.
But that's because it's an effective theory. You yeah. properly derived
you know
effective theory when you had a separation of scales.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
But you can
add some other parameter. You add some other gauge in there.
No, the gauge, that's the point. The parameter has to depend on scales. It has to. So if you do it first at finite temperature, you have a nice clear separation of scales and you can see that. Explicitly, you can do hard thermal loops, you can go beyond hard thermal loops in a systematic way. But that's where you have a clear separation parameter. But it's an example, nonetheless, of a reordering of the loop expansion, which keeps gauge invariance exact.
Mm-hmm. Well, because you have another systematic
yes.
gauge invariant parameter.
Yes.
The separation of scales.
Yes. But if you write down those equations also out of equilibrium, you will not have this problem, this particular problem, maybe other problems. But that would explain why the pressure in equilibrium does not have the gauge parameter dependence. It's not consistent. Once you have hard thermal loops, that gives you a certain topology of diagrams, which you could hope to generalize to this functional method out of equilibrium with external fields, which you don't have in kinetic theory.
I just don't understand what you just said.
If I write down a set of diagrams, which, at least in equilibrium, does not have any gauge parameter dependence, then once I have a field theoretic description of it, just as Meg described, I can also write an out of equilibrium evolution, effective action and evolution equations with mean fields, which you would not easily get from the kinetic description.
I just say kinetic, you know, I say Boltzmann-Vlasov, that's kinetic with mean fields.
Mm-hmm. Well, except that you have interference effects that you don't have in the kinetic theory. It's a quantum theory.
But anyway, it's coming back to 2pi, 3pi, npi. The point you're making is that, in general, probabilities work in gauge invariant way in any gauge theory.
Right.
And
it's more than practical.
Yeah, no, I sort of believe that. I mean, I was willing to accept the special quantity.
You shouldn't
cases.
Accept this right away, what you say.
Jürgen has worked on this for a while, so he has a psychological issue.
I think it is worth... So he made very strong general statements.
But this is this statement.
I think it is general. It's right. You know, the N in NPI is not...
No. So, there is no question that if you go to strong couplings, you will see this dependence. I think it's very good to go to particular calculated quantities, like, for instance, viscosities, transport coefficients, that Meg was just showing us. She shows that it's gauge invariant in the end.
No. She showed that it has these integral equations have background field gauge invariance. As far as I understand, I haven't looked at your paper, so I should postpone this, but as far as I understand, the gauge parameter dependence issue still remains.
Well, I think the important point is your statement that you have to re-expand this thing. And I don't think that's true.
That's what Arizal, that's what's in that paper, Smith. That paper I did go back and look at.
So I would say, and if you carry out the calculation completely till the end, and you actually go through the calculation beyond writing down the integral equations, then you will see that if you compute really the leading order bit, the gauge parameter will drop out. But there will be if you don't make all the approximations you need to do, like put particles on shell which are on the ladders and
for the transport quantity.
If you don't make that approximation, it will not drop out
in 3pi.
in 3PI or 2PI.
I think that's right. I think that's
so,
right.
Oh, because you can you can precisely see why it drops out, and you see what you have to do to make it drop out. So if you take the vertex equations as in a general situation, it will not.
So. Well, that's an interesting assertion, which I want you to confront with the fact that when it comes to actually calculating the transport coefficients, as far as I know, there's no way of calculating, of getting actual result numbers which capture all effects which are not suppressed by powers of the coupling in an explicit, well, in a computable fashion that doesn't actually include some subset of higher order effects. Right? That's what Peter and Guy and I actually did. We did a calculation that captured all the leading order physics, but there were some arbitrary choices in it that had to do with how specific pieces of higher order terms were still left in there.
Okay, I was referring.
And there's some interesting, I think, sort of pretty subtle issues here, because you think you ought to be able to expand it cleanly. You know, it's either leading order or it's higher order. But the point is, leading order involved a non-Borel summable series in powers of 1 over logs of the coupling. So I don't know any way to do what you said,
okay,
which is to isolate the leading order and test whether it alone beautifully.
So I was satisfied with 20.
Now, the way we did it, there was no gauge parameter dependence.
Never enters.
Because that...
It just
that,
isn't there, right?
Because the input into kinetic theory is basically squares of amplitudes, which...
For on-shell scatter.
Look like usual on-shell scatter.
Right.
Okay, so the calculation I was referring to was the leading large NF calculation, which is leading order, but not... Leading order in your sense, in your
problems, right?
And there it works because you reduce the problem precisely to a kinetic theory problem. But you see how it happens.
Yeah.
So you see why it happens, and you understand why it drops out, and also when it will not drop out. But in the calculation that Max gets, the calculation has not been carried out till the end, because you know the very integral equations have been written down, but they have not been, you know, completely. All the integrals have not been done, the massage and so on, to get the numbers out. So we don't know.
But this is what. They've done before, right?
They've done, so that's why there's not so much incentive to do it.
Pieces of those integral equations which you need for leading order, which are precisely the pieces that we use to kinetic theory, are the only pieces you keep.
So if you carry out the program completely till the end, you will be able to precisely get your results. So that's why it's a little bit boring to do that.
How do you know
so
we
for just that quant?
Yeah, well.
For just that quant, but if you look at the evolution equations that come out of 3PI, I think there would be a lot of interesting physics there. And it may be that the long time limit, which is going to the linear regime where you have linear response and the transport properties hold, that particular limit and the last stage of the relaxation is independent of the gauge parameter. That may well be so, but not an intermediate stage. So if you want to do anything more than, you know, just the leading order transport, if you want to actually understand the non-equilibrium evolution, I think this is more than just a trivial problem. I think at some point we'll have to understand it in order to do gauge theories properly.
Especially not a good gauge theory.
Absolutely.
Actually, I don't understand another comment about the Borel, not Borel resolvable. Because if you take those integral equations and you massage them in exactly the same way as you did, but on the kinetic theory, you get exactly the same result. So you should get exactly the same result and the same problems that you encountered in the kinetic calculation. So what's the issue, in some sense? Would you expect to get something better?
You've lost me.
The statement was, if you would do the transport calculation to leading order using 3PI.
Leading order, just to be clear, means not just the leading log, but a constant under the log.
And I mean the whole infinite series in powers of 1 over logs of the couplet. Leading order, I mean you're allowed to drop effects that are suppressed by power of the couplet.
Right, but not logs.
But not logs.
So that calculation you can do by kinetic theory, and you can also do in this setup, provided you make exactly the correct approximations along the way by putting particles on shell. I don't see how you would get something different from what you get in the...
No, I think that was not made...
I mean, the same issues have to come up.
Yeah. Right.
You would actually roll up your sleeves and calculate with this formula.
He just says that one can never cleanly say, I go to leading order. You always have...
Okay, but that's a problem in general.
Every summation that's on the market right now, you always have to resum a whole bunch of graphs or processes which are higher order in the coupling, and you say, okay, it doesn't matter because it's higher order in the coupling. You don't know how to separate this.
I know that's a problem of the physics.
It's the same with NPI. If you could really separate the higher order terms, if you could at any stage in your calculation really expand, that's what Emil is saying, you would find it's higher order in the coupling. But of course, you cannot do it in practice. You may then believe it doesn't matter because parametrically it's higher order in the coupling. But maybe Emil is giving us an example where he explicitly shows that it matters. So in any resummation that's on the market right now, you have to resum an infinite series of processes that you say is not relevant because it's lower in the higher order in the coupling, but you could have done differently. You could have chosen a completely different subset, and maybe the result would have depended on it.
But this is also in kinetic theory. It's what you're saying.
It's the same in kinetic theory, it's the same in any resummation.
But when you talk about not being Borel Sombol, it's the same problem in kinetic theory. Because it's a physics problem, it's not a problem related to the techniques that you use.
I mean, the statement of not Borel Sombol and 1 over logs, that's a statement about the actual result, irrespective of how you calculate, as long as you do it right.
But why would you need to expand the logs if you believed you were calculating things correctly through some integral equation? Hopefully the integral equation would take care of that resummation.
Let me say it differently. You might have thought, without saying expanding in logs, you might have thought that you could express the leading order answer as the appropriate overall powers of coupling, which are trivial, 1 over g to the fourth, times some uniquely defined function of log of g. And that would be it. That everything else would be stressed by powers of g.
If you can and you cannot do that.
We could not find any way to give you a definition of that function of log of g, whose expansion in powers of 1 over log has to agree with leading order, next to leading log, next to leading log, and so on. We couldn't find any way, any calculational scheme that would precisely give you that function without automatically having certain higher order things automatically subsumed into your algorithm for calculating that function. So what we could give you was a variety of different algorithms, which will give you different functions, all of which agree at leading order.
So you could only determine the asymptotic expansion.
I don't like putting it that way. I mean, we actually showed results where we summed that whole series in the sense that we calculated a function which was a leading order approximation, but it wasn't unique.
So it's only the asymptotic expansion that was unique.
Yeah.
So you can only determine the answer.
Which means the leading log.
So it's...
No.
No?
No, it's a whole infinite series in 1 over logs.
It doesn't converge, yeah.
And there was no natural... And none of these prescriptions were preferable.
They didn't. Well, first of all, the good news was they didn't vary enough for reasonable values of coupling to let it bother you. Their variation was actually a useful way of getting a handle on when you should stop believing the calculation.
So that's what you turned as positive here. Yeah? Here you have the same problem. So, for instance, this discussion between...
And it was around some of it. It was not, sorry, it was Borel-Sombol or not?
Not Borel-Sombol. and it's a series in 1/logs, and therefore the what we think of as the non-perturbative ambiguity in other contexts applied here is an ambiguity that's power of the coupling.
And the singularity of the Brownian complex had no origin?
That's not an instant easy thing to answer. We had some arguments that made us think we understood it, but I'm not really satisfied.
So I'm not sure how much of that the technical difficulty is technical and how much of it is physics. There may well be a different way of formulating that. That doesn't arise the same issue.
My guess is that if you carry out the diagram calculation until the end, you arrive at the same ambiguities and the same.
Well, if you have a formulation that isn't yet completely in the kinetic limit, it may well be that those integral equations possess a solution that gives you this function that you've been searching for that has this expansion in logs. If you were to re-expand it, could be, I don't know.
Could be, but the calculation is set up in such a way with the pinching poles, which forces the particles going on shell. I think you will get very close to
it. You're not forced to take the long, you're not forced to take the, to do a gradient expansion, which is how you get the kinetic here. So it could be that these terms have to do with time variations that are not easily accessible in the kinetic approach.
Every technique you use, you use the Kubo formula.
Yes, and
so that, yes. In this strict limit of, you know, zero momentum, zero frequency. So.
Yeah, if your goal is to get transport coefficients.
Yeah, so not
clear. Emphasizing you could choose to focus on a lot of other questions.
Other things, yes. But let's, if you still want to talk about transport coefficients, there will be some set of integral equations that may start to discuss here. And I have no idea really what the technical issue of solving those equations are and whether they'll have this kind of logarithmic Borel.
They have to capture.
No, there's no
question.
No doubt
how much worse are they?
Yeah, there's no doubt if you take all the limits first, that you'll get back to something that looks just like what they considered. But whether if you didn't do that, tried to solve the equation somehow, and then you might get something different. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Isn't it here? Understand this correctly. I mean, this case dependence quite like the scale dependence on finite order perturbation theory. So that, I mean, you can look at the sensitivity. Mm-hmm. You calculate something, you have to excite the answer. You let it vary and then see what kind of error bands you'll trace out.
That's what Bojan is doing.
And if it is good, I mean, you are happy.
But
like the scale dependence in that.
But for the scale dependence, you cannot put any arbitrary value for mu, right?
Zero where minus infinity.
In that case, there's some notion of what's reasonable.
Exactly.
Yeah. Here, you don't
I mean,
have
well, I mean, nobody stops me and put zero infinity
and see what happens. I mean, I don't know what happens. I mean, both are valid cases, of course. So that if it stays under control between zero and infinity.
Yeah, I mean, that, of course, I mean, if you can show that basically whatever you choose for psi, the result still stays in the finite band, then I think you have a solid argument that the answer is also close to that.
I'm not opposed to more practical methods to address it, but I still think, I think it's an interesting theoretical issue to try to understand. Mm-hmm.
Can I mention one thing that's maybe related or useful in some way? So you could take this equation, right, and turn it into the Schwinger-Dyson equation, and in the Schwinger-Dyson community, at least at zero temperature and some attempts at finite temperature have been made, you can close the vertex equation just by imposing essentially the Wirth-Takahashi identity by hand. to write the propagator out, it's just the most general tensor form that it can be in. You write the vertex function out in the most general tensor form it can be in, and then you just use the word Takahashi, or in this case the word identity, to impose constraints on the function that can appear in the vertex.
I think that's what was done by John, basically. He imposed the word identity on it to begin with, and use that to determine what you should put in for the vertex.
But that is not just 2PI, right?
Yeah, it's something else.
The problem that you usually encounter is whenever you have resummation of a subclass of infinite series of diagrams, you finally have to also find a formulation where you have a limited number of counterterms to renormalize your theory. If you stay self-consistent in this NPI framework, for instance, it's just the number of counterterms that you would get in a textbook for theories with composite operators. So you know what to do, it's well defined. Whenever you start plugging in some constraints, you know, from the outside, it's not no longer self-consistent. It's at least very difficult to give a prescription how you to renormalize, you know, infinite subclasses of diagrams to infinite order.
And we haven't talked about renormalization. I mean, there's another set of issues there.
It's a highly non-trivial thing beyond self-consistent approximations. And this Stringer Dyson community you are referring to, it's very interesting what they're doing. And you see that they always use the propagator equation and get that finite. For instance, they first subtract the quadratically running part. Then they take the rest, and they have really great intuition and know what they're doing. But if you then want to, for instance, ask what is the pressure, so for instance, take their propagator solution and plug it in for some expression for pressure, it's so far not worked out how to get a renormalized pressure. So it's very difficult. You may get it for one specific equation, but then you ask more other questions, and the whole question of what counterterms to add appears again. In NPI, it's once you do it for the action, all quantities are renormalized.
But there are new counterterms that are not in the ordinary loop expansion, right, in the NPI.
It's the same as you get when you go to theories with composite fields.
Good.
So you have to renormalize a theory in the presence of composite field operators. So for instance, if you take everything, you know, all relevant and marginal operators, you may not have just A squared, but also propagator. Yeah.
So there are new renormalization of wave function.
Yeah, but it's the same as you do when you have composite field operators.
Yeah.
So it's all...
But I would, okay, this is another discussion, but I would have thought if we were doing field theory in a straightforward way.
Can you just give us the 5-minute version of that on the board?
Yeah.
For pure scalar theory?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a lecture.
It's now 3:20, so it's time for coffee.
Can you understand something by looking what happens in some solid model, like Schwinger's model?
Whose model?
Schwinger model. So
Schwinger model.
Because again, you have logs and you can be somehow another back and theory.
Can, but 1+1 dimensional.
I was just going to stick with scalar, but I'd like to understand your statement a little better. I mean, I'm effectively adding a source for a bilinear operator, something quadratic in the scalar field, but with arbitrary momentum dependence.
Right. So the counterterms you usually have would involve a mass counterterm, a coupling counterterm that would be applied to the four.
Mm-hmm.
And now you would also have to have a counterterm that has, for instance, propagator times propagator, which would be from the canonical dimension, as well the same canonical dimension as the 5 to the 4th term. So you have to construct all operators with your fields with which you parameterize your effective action. If it's the field and the propagator, you would have to have phi squared, you would have to have, let me call it d, and phi to the fourth, and d squared.
So there are a set of new counterterms and new renormalization
conditions. Yeah, all up to the canonical dimension that you would usually have when you count the relevant and marginal operators in your theory. But now also with the composite fields that you introduce, like the field D.
Still, there is a slight problem with this. If I studied this with in Hartree approximation, basically what the mouse do is to introduce for different invariants, group invariants, counter terms, which is an idea which I found in one of your papers. But then what happens is that you can, for example, in the symmetric theory, ON symmetric theory, you can fix the somehow that the couplings are the same and it's symmetric. But if you, because these counter terms run differently with the renormalization scale, that if you run them, then at a different scale, you lose the symmetry of the theory because the running of this coupling are different because they're different functions.
So I'm not sure if I understood your question correctly. Let me ask. So there are, for instance, two ways to calculate a propagator from a 2pi effective action. You once differentiate with respect to the composite field, which Emil called D, mm-hmm. that gives you an equation for D. Mm-hmm. Or you could calculate it by differentiating twice with respect to the fields. Mm-hmm. Both agree only up to higher orders in the coupling if you would reach none. That's the whole issue.
Yes.
Now you ask, so that's how I understood Sven. Yes. Now you ask if I want to give a renormalization condition. Yes. For my quadratically running operators. Mm-hmm. That's the D, and this is what I get by twice differentiating with respect to the fields. Mm-hmm. Then a priori, I could have the idea of giving different renormalization conditions for these different quantities. You don't have to. You could use the same renormalization conditions.
You can.
But you can choose different.
Yes, but the counter terms will be such that the running of this with the renormalization scale is different. So if you let them run, then at a different renormalization scale, all these couplings will be different. The couplings you introduce for in different places in your effective potential or effective action. So, and then you lose the symmetry.
I don't quite understand this. Lose your symmetry, but certainly yes, these two do not agree up to higher orders in the coupling. For instance, and then they run differently.
Yes, yes. So the coupling which appears in the classical part is different from the coupling you have in the trace log, for example. And of course, there is you can prescribe a renormalization condition where every coupling is the same. Yes, you can do this, but you cannot study this running of the coupling because then you are not in the same theory. You don't have the theory doesn't have the same symmetry.
That last bit I don't understand.
Because the running of the coupling are different. Mm-hmm. So if now I think that
what symmetry are you concerned with?
For example, I write an ON symmetric theory.
And are you now?
So you're going to.
I don't understand what you said before implies breaking the symmetry in your choices of counterterms to add to your action.
Only if I think now in the as a bare theory, then I add the coupling and the counter term, because then the bare coupling will be different at a different scale, because the counter terms are running differently with the scale. But that's what I'm meaning by that we lose the symmetry.
It's not physical symmetry that you're losing. You just want something.
Yes.
You
want
them
to be S1 symmetric.
I think what you're saying is, if I choose the counter terms for the fundamental field and the composite field to be the same, mm-hmm. at one scale, they won't be the same at another scale.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
But when you say lose the symmetry, are you just saying this issue about water identities in a different way? That the water identities of the exact theory
yes,
are not
of
going
course.
To be maintained.
Of course, yes. Yes. At a different scale,
it's
by looking
it's the
at
same thing.
Their theory, it won't be...
Even on the scale of
yes.
ON theory,
yes.
You can
so
see
I
that.
Can see in the ON theory.
I can jump in. I mean, this 2PI or NPI, whatever, effective actions, originally stemmed from the interest of making theory conserving. And this actually implied a relation between self-energies, that if you include something in the self-energy, you have to include some counterpart. And then it seems to me that once you violate, for example, the word identities, means that you working just concentrating on the effective action, you have lost this connection to the conserving approach.
You see, these conserving statements mm-hmm. were for global symmetries. This
okay.
is still preserved. That's why NPI was so interesting for out of equilibrium. You don't
mm-hmm.
want to have not energy conservation
mm-hmm.
base built into your formalism, for instance. Yeah, you don't want to have dissipative terms put
mm-hmm.
in by hand.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly a very good feature of these approximations for initial value problems.
Mm-hmm.
But that only concerns global symmetries, but that's
mm-hmm.
not touched here
okay.
in this discussion.
Okay. But you can derive local laws from, you know, when you're addressing the issue of conserving approximation, you're actually called. If you have a local theory, you deal with local laws.
So what conservation are you worried about now?
Conservation, you know, conserving current.
Which current? You're talking about electromagnetism?
Electromagnetism,
about...
and, you know. And then if you use some approximation in terms of Dyson equation with arbitrary self-energy insertions or vertices and so on, you will break the conservations that the theory originally has. And so you have to if you include something, it's basically these are identities on expectation values that you approximate. And then by constructing effective action, the idea was that you would do that at the level of action, and then differentiations would automatically generate the conservation. And if they don't, if there is an arbitrariness in the way, you know, in the result which you get from differentiation, then that's, to me, I mean, I would look at the connection between the approximation to this expectation values that you make in the first place. If you cannot go back, that's it.
We should pick this up on another occasion.
All right, let's thank Matt again.
Yeah, you didn't want to do all this in one day anyway.
Oh.